It's 4:06. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me next week. Coming up, we'll look at a new report on the growing risk of suicide in the nation's rural areas and the resources available here in Wisconsin for those who need help. First, the state's honey production took a hit last year, causing Wisconsin to fall out of the nation's top 10 ranking in production. For a look at what's behind that decline and the outlook for this year is Matt LaForge. He's vice president of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how bad was last year? How much did honey production drop?
It was down about 25% below average statewide. A lot of that was attributable to weather and some lower colony numbers, too.
Yeah, let's break those both apart. I think a lot of us remember last winter being a really bad one. I didn't know it had such a big impact on our bee population. How much damage did that do?
Last winter, the winter before this one, the losses statewide were well over 50% of hives that went into winter died before spring. So beekeepers were able to replace most of those losses, but hive numbers were still down in the state overall.
And were some beekeepers wiped out completely by that that cold?
Some people did lose 100% of their operation. That long, prolonged, continual cold is really hard on the bees, and there's not a lot that the beekeepers can do about it. Most were able to get back in, but maybe not at the numbers of hives that they're used to running.
And does it take time for a hive to get into full production? Is the hive somebody's had going for a couple years more productive than their spring replacement hive?
Absolutely. A second-year hive will always produce more. It kind of takes them a year to build out new honeycomb and get started. So that first year is usually a down year.
Now, when we hear anything about bees and honey, I think of the colony collapse disorder we're reading about around the country. Is that a factor in honey production here in Wisconsin?
There have been cases of it. It's probably not the major thing. Last year, probably the biggest thing was just the severe winter, as well as pests and diseases that the bees are facing, and habitat loss, pesticides, that kind of thing. Colony collapse itself is really a very specific syndrome that really hasn't been documented in that many cases.
Talking to Matt LaForge with Wisconsin Honey Producers Association about a decline last year in honey production in the state. And Matt wanted to get more into that that environmental side of things. Do we have the diversity of plant life that our honeybees need?
It's declining every year. Bees rely on wildflowers and what most of us think of as weeds. Those used to be abundant on the edges of fields and in hedgerows and that kind of thing. But as agriculture gets more monocropping and fields get larger and those hedgerows pull out, that is a major loss of forage and habitat for the bees.
Has there been an effort to turn that around and have more of that weedy, flowery plant life that these bees need?
There have been a few initiatives ranging from the federal level to the county level to encourage farmers to return some land back to wildflowers or pasture and that kind of thing, but it's not keeping up with the rate that the habitat is being destroyed.
Now, maybe a dumb bee question here, but are the same bees producing our honey the ones that we're counting on to pollinate a lot of different kinds of crops?
Yep, that's one and the same. Honeybees pollinate about a third of our food crops. So every third bite of food that you eat is directly attributable to honeybee pollination.
So a lot of people have a stake on that. Even if we don't personally eat or produce honey, this has an effect outside of honey itself.
Absolutely, yeah. Almost all your fruits and vegetables and nuts will require or benefit from honeybee pollination, and even things like dairy indirectly, because the cows eat the alfalfa, which has to be pollinated by honeybees. So it really has very far-reaching effects.
Now, this winter, not as bad, not as cold, as enduring as last winter. Are things looking better in 2015?
It was a better winter this winter. Losses were still high. It's probably 40% statewide lost, but not nearly as bad as last winter. So we're optimistic for this year.
And some people might think, okay, what can I do to help bees in the state? Is this something where people can make a difference with backyard bee gardens and things like that?
Absolutely. Looking for pollinator-friendly plants can make a big difference in your yards. The biggest thing, the hardest time for bees is the first thing in the spring and the last thing in the fall. So looking for plants that bloom either very, very early or very, very late are especially helpful.
I think I read that some commercially available plants that we might plant in our garden actually aren't that great for bees. They may have residues of pesticides that could hurt them.
Some of the plants you get at garden centers will have seeds that were grown from seeds that were treated with neonicotinoids, which may be harmful to bees. So you have to kind of check with individual garden centers, but they should be able to tell you that. But staying away from those would be a good idea if your goal is to help pollinators.
Now, I've read in the past that some people have left the honeybee trade altogether due to the challenges of colony collapse, the habitat issues you mentioned. Is that a long-term trend that you're seeing in Wisconsin?
There are a lot of commercial beekeepers, more and more getting out every year. There's a lot of interest in backyard beekeeping. As far as new beekeepers coming in, there's probably more this year than ever before on people who just want to have bees in their backyard to make a little honey or for enjoyment or to pollinate their own gardens. But there is a major concern, the rate at which we're losing commercial beekeepers.
We'll leave it there for now. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Matt LaForge. He's Vice President of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association, talking about the decline in honey production last year. A new study out this month finds a troubling trend among young people in the nation's rural areas, especially as compared to their urban counterparts. They're committing suicide in significantly higher numbers. The study found that the suicide rate for young people in rural areas is nearly double that of youth in urban areas. So what's behind that? What can be done to reduce those numbers? In just a few minutes, we'll talk to a guest about resources available in rural Wisconsin to those who might be experiencing suicidal thoughts and feelings. First, we welcome in the lead author of the study we're talking about, Cynthia Fontanella. She's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Cynthia, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob.
So as we mentioned in the intro there, the rural youth suicide rate, almost double that of their urban peers. Put that into context for us. What kind of numbers are we looking at?
Well, I don't know the exact, over the 15-year time period, that equals 67,000 children died, both male and females, of suicide. And the rates were double, as you mentioned, two times higher in rural areas than in urban areas.
Well, let's look at some of the possible reasons you talk about in your report. Let's start with the available of mental health services in rural areas. How are we doing as a country on that?
Well, we're doing pretty poorly. We know that there's a lot of reasons why these disparities are occurring. One of the major reasons, as you mentioned, is lack of availability of mental health services. In rural areas, there's a chronic shortage of mental health services. For example, often in many of these rural areas, there's not a single psychiatrist, psychologist, or social worker. Even when services are available, rural residents have to travel miles, often 60 or 70 miles, to get to a healthcare professional. And so by the time they have to wait much longer for appointments. By the time they get to appointments, their problems are often more severe, and they often require more intensive and costly services. And an added barrier is the stigma. In rural areas, there's a disproportionate level of stigma. Rural residents are often reluctant to seek help for mental health problems. there's kind of a culture of individualism, self-reliance, a belief that you have to solve problems on your own, which can often lead to suicide. And there's a, just a general negative perception towards help seeking.
Well, now, even if someone has the wants to seek help and has something available to them, there's the affordability issue. And you, in your report, talk about the economics of rural America as another barrier here.
That's right. Over the 15-year time period, there's been a number of socio-demographic and economic changes. One is the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009, and rural areas were hit especially hard. This has had a strong effect on the infrastructure in rural areas. They have higher rates of unemployment, loss of jobs, and increasing poverty rates, which leads to, you know, hopelessness, depression, and suicidal feelings. The other major kind of socioeconomic factor is that nearly half of non-metro counties lost population throughout migration and decreased birth rates from 1990 to 2010, which is when we did this study. With one-third of these studies losing about 10% or more of their population. And the highest concentration of these losses was among the young adult group.
And you also looked at the role of gun ownership. What did you find?
Well, we know that guns are, gun ownership is much greater in rural areas compared to urban areas. Owning and using guns is much more common. In rural residents often grow up around guns, have guns in their homes, use them for hunting, agricultural needs, recreation, and just simply because there's a culture of guns. In fact, we found that in rural areas, suicide by firearm and hanging were disproportionately higher, almost 2.7 to 3.3 times higher in rural areas compared to urban areas. And we know that gun ownership in urban areas is declining, but in rural areas it's remaining stable, if not increasing.
And one other twist on this, this is disproportionately young men in rural areas. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. We know that just in general, males are four times more likely to commit suicide compared to females.
And before we let you go, Cynthia, what recommendations do you have to try to bring these numbers of youth rural suicides down?
Well, there's a number of things that we can do. There's three promising approaches in particular. One is integrating physical healthcare, mental health care within primary care settings. We know that 65% of rural residents see their primary care doctor as the first gatekeeper. And so if we can integrate mental health professionals within these settings, this would help to address some of these access barriers and availability barriers, as well as address some of the stigma issues, because rural residents tend to trust primary care providers much more than specialists. Another approach is telemedicine, which is the use of videotaping and use of internet and Skype. This is also a promising practice. And in terms of youth suicides, school-based interventions and gatekeeper training has also shown to be effective in reducing suicide rates in rural areas.
Cynthia, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Cynthia Fontanella. She's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at The Ohio State University. She was the lead author of a recent report on the growing gap between urban and rural suicide rates. Now we turn to another guest to talk about the resources available to those in rural Wisconsin and anywhere in the state, really, who might be at risk for suicide. Shell Gross is the director of public policy for Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Shell, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, Rob.
So, Shel, we've been hearing about nationwide statistics here. What do we know about suicide numbers here in Wisconsin?
In general, we know that for youth, our suicide rate is actually a little bit above, actually quite a bit above the national average.
Why is that? Do we know?
We don't know exactly, but I think many of the factors that Cynthia talked about are true here. We have a largely rural state, and so a number of the factors that she talked about would certainly come into play in terms of affecting our rates.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the warning signs of suicide that someone might watch for in themselves or in a loved one?
Sure. Yeah, generally, when you see major changes in things, so somebody who starts sleeping a lot more or sleeping a lot less, changes in mood that are very different from their typical mood. Among young people, one of the things you'll sometimes see is they'll give away things that are important to them because they're starting to make a plan about completing suicide. So clearly increase in impulsive or risky behaviors can indicate some concerns as well. So there are a variety of kinds of warning signs.
Now, for someone living in a rural part of Wisconsin who might be feeling suicidal or might have someone close to them showing the signs you just talked about, they're looking for help, what's a good place to turn?
Well, one place anybody can turn is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 1-800-273-TALK. And that's 273-8255. That is a 24/7 phone line. Most of those calls are actually answered in Wisconsin, so there's somebody who is highly trained to respond to either the individual themselves who's suicidal or somebody who's calling on their behalf to help them. And because most of those are offered answered in Wisconsin, folks will be aware of the kinds of resources we have here for people.
And then, after that first step, what kind of resources do we have in Wisconsin?
So one place to look, especially in rural areas, every county has a human service department, and they have their own crisis services. We have a website in Wisconsin, Prevent Suicide Wisconsin, which is our statewide suicide prevention website. You can click on a map there of any county and find the information for that county's crisis services. So that's a number people can call first if they wish, but they also then can provide additional crisis response for individuals who might be at immediate risk. Beyond that, the county will be able to tell you what sort of mental health services are available, in the area. As Cynthia said, in rural areas, often there are fewer and further between, but that doesn't mean they're not there at all. Last session, the legislature did approve some expansion of mental health services, which is starting to put in place some additional mental health services, especially for kids. It won't still meet all the need, but it's going to help. And Wisconsin is also starting a program for providing psychiatric consultation to pediatricians. So it's not exactly the kind of integration that Cynthia was talking about, but we hope that more rural primary care physicians will have access to psychiatrists to help them if they're working with a young person who does have mental health needs.
Another recommendation from researcher Cynthia Fontanella was the idea of school outreach. Since we're talking here about youth suicide, do we have these kind of things in place in Wisconsin, or is there room for improvement?
Well, there's always room for improvement, but the Department of Public Instruction has done a lot of work providing education and resources to schools around suicide prevention. We have worked with them as well to train teachers to better recognize and know how to respond to young people who may be suicidal. There's curriculum that the Department of Public Instruction has developed for students so that they can better understand both mental health and how to respond to peers who might be suicidal. So the schools definitely are an important locus of activity, and also very importantly as protective factors. People, young kids get support in schools as well, and a supportive school environment is one that can actually reduce the risk of suicide for young people.
Is there something, Shell, that would be on your wish list if we could make one change in public policy or even in our culture that you think would really help reduce those numbers of youth suicide in the state?
Well, you know, Cynthia mentioned stigma, and we know that continues to be a huge factor. The attitudes about mental illness get in the way of people seeking help, being willing to talk about what's going on with themselves because of their fears about how people will respond. So I think that still remains a huge issue, and we just need the continued education so people understand better that, you know, I do know people who have mental health challenges. They do recover and get better. I don't need to be afraid of them. They need our support, and if they get that, it's going to be helpful for them.
Shell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. You're welcome. Thanks, Rob.
We've been talking to Shell Gross, Director of Public Policy for Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We also heard from Cynthia Fontanella, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up this weekend is the premiere of the last season of Mad Men. That got us thinking, what TV shows were you sad to see go away? We'll take your calls on the TV shows you miss coming up in a little bit. First, an update on a story we've been following, the controversy over the Toma VA Medical Center. Yesterday in Toma, there was a joint field meeting of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs and the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. The meeting featured testimony from people on what they say was overprescription of opioids at the Toma VA and an atmosphere of retaliation against whistleblowers. Maureen McCollum was at the hearing yesterday. She's WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. Maureen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So set the scene for us. What was the mood like at this hearing in Toma?
It was incredibly emotional. There were two different panels that testified before these eight members of Congress. The first panel consisted of two whistleblowers, former Toma VA employees, and then three family members of veterans who died as patients of the Toma VA. We heard from the family of Jason Simkakoski. He's a Marine Corps veteran who people may have read about his story. He passed away last August while a patient at the Toma VA facility. Basically, he was given a lethal combination of medications that contributed to his death. His widow, Heather Simkakoski, spoke before the panel, and his father, Marvin Simkakoski, also spoke. They both live in Stevens Point right now. And the point that they were trying to get across is that, you know, they saw these changes that Jason was going through after he was prescribed just these high level of opiates. He started missing work. He had troubles getting out of bed. Heather talked about Jason falling asleep while he was eating dinner. And Marvin, his father, talked about how he really pushed and tried to get doctors to change Jason's prescriptions. They really tried to get him off of these strong narcotic drugs and didn't really have much luck. You know, and obviously it in ways, I mean, his death is under investigation right now, but, you know, the mixed toxicity is what led to his death. And essentially what they're asking for is that they want employees and staff to take responsibility and to be held accountable. We heard from another woman, Candace Dellis, who lives near Marshfield. Her father, he's an Army veteran, Thomas Baer. He actually went to the Toma VA to be treated for some health issues, ended up having a stroke while in the waiting room. The family argues that staff were slow to respond. A CT machine was down that day. He wasn't given anti-clotting medication. There were some other issues. So the family had to quickly rush him over to La Crosse, where he suffered another stroke and ended up dying. That family is currently, I think they plan on suing the VA over that situation. So, you know, when these family members testified, you could see, and I mean, it was quite emotional. And we had the different lawmakers just asking them about, you know, the care that their family members received and what they wish would have been different, and another of other issues.
And Maureen, you mentioned also that former employees testified at this, including a former pharmacist at the center. What kind of things did we hear from people who had worked there on this opiate prescription issue?
Yeah, we heard from Dr. Noelle Johnson. She was formerly a pharmacist at the Tomo VA in 2008 and 2009. This was her first job out of school. So, you know, they have a one-year probationary period. And during that time, she had raised concerns that incredibly high levels, just different prescriptions were coming through of morphine and different other prescriptions. She said she was uncomfortable. She felt like some of the prescriptions were coming in were unsafe, and she refused to fill some of them. She said she faced retaliation from certain staff members for refusing to fill those. She essentially told me that she did not want to contribute to a veteran dying. Not only that, but she said that some of these prescriptions that were coming through to her were straight up illegal. She faced retaliation for that. She said she was screamed at. She got to the point where she had to fax instructions to a supervisor because he couldn't control his anger around her. Ultimately, 2 days before her probationary period ended, she was fired from the Tomo VA. She filed complaints and whatnot, and essentially they settled out of court. So this yesterday was the first day that she's been able to speak publicly about her situation. She went on to work at a commercial pharmacy afterwards, but actually she's back within the VA. She's working at the Des Moines VA in the pharmacy there, where she said the situation's not perfect, but it is a much better situation, and they are doing a lot to address pain management differently. We also heard from another whistleblower, Ryan Honnell, who he served in the Gulf War. He was a veteran himself and worked last year at the Tomo VA as a mental health secretary. His issues were that he says he was asked to lie about certain records. He was asked to, basically forge documents, and he wasn't comfortable with that. After he started raising flags about that, he started facing retaliation in his own ways. You know, he talks about how he has PTSD from his experience in the Gulf War. After he started raising some concerns about what was going on within the Tomo VA, you know, he felt like there were almost these underhanded comments like, oh, how's Ryan doing today? Almost referring to his mental state when that had nothing to do with the issues he was bringing up. So he talked about that. And essentially his main message was that when it comes to accountability within the Tomo VA, I mean, we need to be looking much higher. We need to be looking at the federal level, and people need to be held accountable from the top to the bottom.
We're talking to Maureen McCollum, WPR reporter based in La Crosse, about yesterday's hearing in Tomo, looking at accusations of overprescription of pain medication at the Tomo VA facility and of retaliation, as we've been hearing, against whistleblowers. Now, in addition to those two panels that you've been talking about, Maureen, we heard that Interim Undersecretary for Health at the VA, Carolyn Clancy, faced some tough questions at the meeting yesterday. Let's hear some of her now.
We have been very, very clear about that. Secretary McDonald, Deputy Secretary Gibson, and I, and other senior leaders, there is absolutely no tolerance, no retaliation against whistleblowers.
So it sounds like there has been retaliation against whistleblowers.
What
were the exchanges like between her and the members of the congressional delegation there?
At times it got a bit contentious, but I think we heard from a lot of lawmakers actually thanking Dr. Clancy for what seems to be, you know, some beginning steps in the change of culture. Dr. Clancy has only been in her position for, I believe it's a little over a year, but she is very serious about saying, we won't tolerate this. This will no longer happen at the VA. She also talked about how she talked about different steps that the VA is taking just to deal with pain management, you know, because we have the retaliation issue, but we also have this major opioid usage issue. Essentially, she said that the situation at the Tomo VA, when it comes to opiates, when it comes to retaliation, has failed veterans, and they continued to fail the staff, too. There are different things that need to be done when it comes to addressing the opioid issue. And the VA is taking on different programs nationally. They're you know, starting different ways to track opiate prescriptions differently. They want to start different educational programs, just working essentially holistically with different clinicians to work with patients when it comes to, you know, weaning a veteran off really intensive narcotics, because, I mean, you can't just cut someone off. Someone who's suffering from chronic pain, you can't just cut them off from their medications. You have to work with them medically, psychologically, sociologically, you know, and introduce different practices like chiropractic care. You know, they're looking actually even at embedding acupuncturists within different units that are serving abroad. So looking at this pain issue differently, even, you know, on the battlefields when soldiers are serving overseas. So that's a lot of what she talked about. The more heated arguments became between some other people that were on the VA panel that she was serving on.
Right, I understand there's an exchange between Congressman Sean Duffy and Tomah VA Medical Center Director Mario DeSantis.
Yep. So Mario DeSantis actually has been temporarily reassigned from his position as the Medical Center Director at the Tomah VA while there are several investigations going on right now in the facility. And Sean Duffy did not hold back when it came to pressing the different VA officials on these different issues. He questioned how DeSantis, you know, how he says he didn't know what was going on. DeSantis said, well, I was handling different things. Duffy basically said that DeSantis and others really failed people like Jason Simkakoski, the Marine veteran who passed away at the Tomah VA. He failed their families. You know, Duffy also really dug into the fact that these nursing shortages have to be addressed within the, you know, whether it's a Tomah VA issue or a VA issue at large is unknown. But then, you know, Duffy also said that it's incredibly problematic in his eyes that people haven't been fired yet for these different issues. But I think all of that is pending these different investigations.
Now, Dr. David Houlihan, chief of staff through the period we're talking about, has been at the center of this story. The initial investigative reports said patients, some referred to him as the candy man because of how many prescriptions he was handing out. Did his name come up at this hearing? What kind of things were said?
His name came up a lot. Dr. Houlihan was not present at the hearing, but his name came up when Dr. Noelle Johnson, she's the pharmacist there, she's the one that said that Dr. Houlihan screamed in her face when she questioned the prescription practices. There were actually, you know, Dr. Houlihan, his name came up when it came to a series of deaths that are under investigation right now. Senator Tammy Baldwin had brought up an issue with a death that occurred apparently 7 years ago. A veteran named Craig Farrington, who in 2007 died of a lethal combination of prescriptions at the Tomah VA, sort of similar to what happened with Jason Simkakoski. He was under the care of Dr. Houlihan, and apparently there was a medical malpractice suit that was filed against the VA. It went through some appeals, and essentially, Houlihan came out on top. Lawmakers are asking that be looked into again. Baldwin actually called for investigation into 24 deaths that occurred within the Tomah VA. I'm not sure what all of those are at this point, and it might include that Craig Farrington issue. There was another death that was brought up at the hearing that was quite interesting. Actually, the Tomah VA Staff Employee Union, the American Federation of Government Employees, they are pressing and almost advocating for a former coworker who passed away a few years ago. Dr. Chris Kirkpatrick is a former Tomah VA psychologist who apparently he was working there temporarily, and he was questioning the large amount of narcotics that were given to patients who were being treated for PTSD and substance abuse. He was retaliated against for questioning these prescription practices. Eventually, he was terminated from his position, and that day he went home and committed suicide. I don't believe there's an investigation into that, but essentially what the staff union is saying is that this cannot happen. We need better protections for whistleblowers. We need better just support as staff here who are dealing with highly stressful workloads and caseloads, and just to make sure that this never happens again.
As we wrap up, Maureen, a bipartisan panel, congresspeople, senators from both parties, it sounds like they're serious. They want to see some changes here from the VA.
You know, it does. And to see a bipartisan panel, especially at this day and age, was very interesting. And I think some people were pretty hopeful about it because we didn't see any partisan bickering whatsoever. you know, the lawmakers say they are determined to make sure that this is fixed. It's all yet to be seen once they get back to Washington. There has been some legislation that's been introduced. Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse, he's introduced a Veterans Pain Management Improvement Act, which would essentially create these pain management boards in each of the VISNs. That's the Veterans Integrated Service Network. Toma's part of VISN 12. It's just, you know, a regional network of the different VA hospitals. But it would just be these group of people who would really look at the different prescriptions going on. There have been a number of whistleblower and retaliation acts that have been introduced in Congress. But, you know, a lot of this is up to the VA closing out their investigations and making sure that people are held accountable, because overall that's what the message was yesterday, that people need to be held accountable for these actions.
Maureen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's Maureen McCollum, WPR reporter based in La Crosse, looking at the latest, this hearing yesterday on the Toma VA Medical Center. This Sunday kicks off the final episodes of Mad Men, which got us thinking, what TV show were you heartbroken to see end? What show do you still miss maybe to this day? Here's a clip of Don Draper making a sales pitch to get us in the Mad Men mood.
But it doesn't change the fact that we're happy with our agency.
Are you? You're happy with 50%. You're on top and you don't have enough. You're happy because you're successful, for now. But what is happiness? It's a moment before you need more happiness. I won't settle for 50% of anything. I want 100%. You're happy with your agency? You're not happy with anything. You don't want most of it. You want all of it. And I won't stop until you get all of it.
Well, I'm sold. We also just heard that season 6 of PBS favorite Downton Abbey will be its last season. Are you sad to see these shows go? Or what show from the past or recent past do you wish were still churning out some new episodes? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jackie on the line in Sauk City. Jackie, hi.
Hi.
What's your show, Jackie?
I would love to see the show Freaks and Geeks come back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that only lasted like one season, right?
Yeah, I think it was maybe one or two seasons, but there was a lot of big names like James Franco, Seth Rogen, Jason Segel. I think Billy Busy Phillips were all in it, and it was about a group of teenagers from the 70s. And it was an awesome show.
It was one of the more real-feeling high school shows, not like glamorous, rich California kids, just Midwestern. I like that one. And actually,
yeah.
So that's a good one, Jackie. Thank you for that. We asked our coworkers about this. James Wagner, our payroll coordinator, listed Freaks and Geeks. And one of my favorites, Firefly, too, was on a lot of people's list. So those are in the category of shows that ended too soon, shows that were cut short. Back to our callers now. We've got Abby with us in Appleton. Abby, hi.
Hi there.
What's your show?
Well, the show I would love to see come back, which would be pretty hard, but is Breaking Bad.
Oh, okay. But that's one that ran a long time. It got its mileage, and then it came to an end. Isn't that kind of satisfying in its way?
Not really, and not the way it ended. I think it could have drawn out a lot more, and they still could take it in other directions.
Abby, thanks a lot for sharing that one. You know, on a related note, Peter on Facebook said, I like it when TV shows end, especially the good ones, especially early. Firefly, he says, was great because it didn't take 6 months to rewatch the entire thing. The best stories, Peter says, leave you wanting more. Too often a TV show drags on far past that point. Well, Peter, interesting point. I will argue on the Firefly. I could use another season or two for that one, like a space cowboy show, if you haven't seen that. We are talking about shows that you were sad when they ended, shows you missed, maybe you wanted to come back. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Holly is with us now in Wausau. Holly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, what's your show?
It would be Witches of East End. It only made two seasons, and I think it was on the Lifetime channel.
Okay, so was that a spinoff on the concept of the Witches of Eastwick, the movie?
I believe so. Something similar to that one, and also like Charmed.
Okay, so you like magic in your TV shows.
Yes.
Well, great. Thank you so much for sharing those, Holly. Well, as I said, we asked around our WPR co-workers to see what some of their favorites were. A lot of Firefly. Bill Martins with the Joy Cardine Show said 24. He says, I admit it got fairly predictable and over the top towards the end. Watching Jack Bauer systematically taking down bad guys by any means necessary never got old. He still likes to binge on it. Yeah, I worked in an office with Bill. You can never stop talking about 24. Back to your calls now. We've got Dino on the line in Madison. Dino, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Probably no one remembers this. It ended in 1994, but it had five seasons, and that's Northern Exposure. Brilliant writing. That went too soon.
Nobody remembers it. That was a big deal back in the day, and I think a big deal
it was.
Ended.
That's more than 20 years ago. You know, but yeah, it was an excellent show. Really, really good TV.
It was interesting location, interesting quirky characters. Do you think anything has lived up to that since then, Dino?
No.
Nothing.
Just in short.
Except no substitutes Northern Exposure. Thanks for that, Dino.
I loved it.
We'll go to Tom in Madison now. Tom, hi.
I don't want to sound redundant. The previous caller, it's gone back, early 90s, Northern Exposure.
No kidding.
I thought overall it was the best show I've ever seen. I miss it. One episode in particular that stands out in terms of, you know, just the beautiful writing for all the eccentric characters. It was, I believe, in season four, The Big Feast. I just remember that particular one. It was just a hilarious episode, and just a show I really miss.
Have you gone back and watched it, Tom, on DVD or streaming?
It's been years, to be honest with you.
Okay, well, maybe you're due for another look if you haven't found a substitute. Thanks a lot for that, Tom. Taking your calls with your TV shows you missed, TV shows you were sad when they ended, with Mad Men hitting its last season, Downton Abbey announcing its last season. Richard is with us next in Milwaukee. Richard, hi.
Hi. Other than Gilligan's Island, I got it. That's a joke. Other than would be The Killing. Definitely The Killing.
So that's there's like murder and there's mysteries. My wife is watching this one. I haven't watched it. So there's a lot of murder shows out there. What makes The Killing special?
Well, the actors are phenomenal. The writing is phenomenal. It's really the characters that are drawn. I think it ran for like two seasons. I'm pretty sure on that. And they didn't have enough money to continue it. It's a shame. It's a wonderful, wonderful show.
Fantastic, Richard. Thanks for that suggestion. We've got Teresa in Viroqua with us now. Teresa, hi.
Hi.
What's your show?
Well, I'm with you on the Firefly and Freaks and Geeks. I love both of those. But I also like Pushing Daisies and Wonder Falls. I think they're the same writer, and they were really well written and acted.
Wonder Falls was great. It was kind of a magical realism set in Niagara Falls, right?
Correct.
And what was Pushing Daisies? I don't think I saw that one.
It was the one who played the brother on Wonder Falls was the main character, who was a man who had a supernatural ability to bring someone back to life. But if he touched them again, they would die. And
wow.
If he didn't touch them, then someone else would have to die.
High concept. Teresa, thanks so much. Some others we heard from our coworkers are The Big Boss, Mike Crane, Sports Night was one of his favorites. Rich Kramer, reporter in Eau Claire, American Gladiators. I don't know. I watched it. I didn't feel an emotional attachment, but hey, more power to you. Rick Ryer from Wausau, MI5, Sherlock, Top Shot, all British shows, I think. You can keep sharing your favorites over at the Central Time Facebook page, the shows you're going to miss. We'll go out to the news with the Downton Abbey theme song.